Can you describe the conference on the two decisions, the Williams versus Georgia? The first was, the first case at least was decided in June of 55, and the second decision in the case came down in January of 56.
The first case, Williams v. Georgia, was number 412, I think, the 1954 term. And there were four members of the court voting to grant the petition for certiorari. They were Clark, myself, Black, and Warren. The case was argued, or during the argument, or about the time of the argument, I forget. But at the time the case was being considered on the merits, Harlan wrote a memorandum urging that the case be sent back to the Georgia Supreme Court for reconsideration. The question by the court was whether there was an adequate state ground. Raised in the Avery case concerning the use of yellow tickets and white tickets in the jury box, distinguishing Negro jurors from white jurors, was applicable. And the opinion, as it was finally settled upon, the majority of the court, a majority of six, written by Frankfurter, speaks for itself, saying that there was partly an entanglement of federal question with state question, and that the case should go back for reconsideration by the Georgia Supreme Court. At the conference, the Chief Justice just would reverse outright and not do what Harlan urged in his memo, have the case sent back to the state court. And Black was inclined to that view, and I felt that it should be reversed outright. Then there were some dissenters. So what Frankfurter finally worked out was somewhat of a compromise to get a court action. And it turned out to be a rather sad sequel, because when the Georgia court reconsidered, there were, it seemed pretty clear that they put the decision on a state ground that would be very difficult to implicate in a federal question in reverse. On the miscellaneous docket number 328 in the 1955 term, there were no clear votes to grant. There were three on the border, doubtful what to do. They were Harlan, Black, and the Chief, Earl Warren. And the rest of the court, including myself, thought that we were boxed in, that the Georgia Supreme Court had placed the decision on a state ground. found that could not be overridden by us and our limited appellate jurisdiction. This case is a little bit like the Minnesota tea case, I think it was. I wrote it back in 309 or 310. It didn't involve racial discrimination. It involved a question, as I recall, whether the Supreme Court of Minnesota had applied its due process clause or the due process clause of the 14th Amendment in making a ruling. I was persuaded by Frankfurter, who was always very strong in the scheme of federalism, to keep the court out of all possible collisions or conflicts with state courts, and therefore would go to great lengths at times to try to find a reason to send the case back so that the state court could reconsider in light of the argument before us and the questions that had been raised in our minds. I took the lead and wrote the opinion for the court, sending it back. We got a very sharp rebuke from the Supreme Court of Minnesota, which said, in effect, that any fool would know by reading their first opinion that they had nothing to do with the federal constitution, but only with the state constitution. Something to that effect. In our conference discussions, we referred to the Minnesota tea case and some other members of the court. Black, I think, was one who, along with me, was getting a little gun-shy of Frankfurter's treatment, but we went along, we agreed to go along, and we felt that we had gone out on a limb and had the limb sawed off by the state court again in this Williams v. Georgia case, and that since the Georgia court had written another opinion making explicit whether in good faith or not, making clear that this was nothing to do with the federal constitution, this was an adequate state ground, we felt boxed in, and that is why the case wasn't taken the second time, and why all of the energies of the court were exhausted in an exercise of futility, which emphasizes in the minds of some of us that it's much better judicial administration if at a conference discussion the votes shape up prospectively as involving merely a remand, not to toss the case but let it lie, rather than try to bring it up and then have it affirmed on an adequate state ground, or remanded for reconsideration by a state court, which usually infuriates a state court.
In this case, the Georgia judge has certainly appeared urgent.
Yes.
And they had very strong language.
Yes, they got up quite a head of steam. that's the essence of it. And in the conferences since the Georgia case, Minnesota T and Williams v. Georgia have been referred to as the court's biggest, some of the court's biggest mistakes in dealing with state courts. So I think there's a tendency since the Williams v. Georgia and since the retirement of Frankfurter to do less and less of that, and either just deny cert or to
reverse
outright, like the Chief and Black and I wanted to do in Williams v. Georgia.
I was wondering if we might go to another case. I know you said there isn't much on these cases in your notes, but I wonder if you could discuss just what you have on the conference and on Watkins versus U.S., which was decided in June of 57, and Barenblatt versus U.S., which was decided in June of 59.
Well, the Watkins case was number 261 in the 1956 term. It came in during the summer, and we voted on it in October, the first week in October, and there were six to grant the petition. Brennan hadn't arrived, I don't believe. Well, Minton was still on the court. Minton and Reed voted to deny the petition, and Burton didn't participate. I think Burton didn't participate because I believe he had a nephew or some relative in the prosecutor's office in the District of Columbia. And those voting to grant included not only myself and Black and Warren, but also Harlan and Clark and Frankfurter. That's in the Watkins case. By the time the case was argued, Brennan had arrived, and he joined myself, Black, and the Chief, plus Harlan and Frankfurter, on the vote to the merits to reverse, with only Clark voting to affirm. Not a long debated case. majority had crystallized very strongly, and there was they had become immovable. And so, weighing of convincing anybody in the majority or anybody in the minority. So I think the upshot of it was that, for some reason or other, Watkins was greatly watered down, and there was generally a retreat from Watkins.
I have a minor question on this, almost irrelevant, but you reminded me of something I wondered about. You may recall in his Watkins dissent, that Justice Clark, rather was his Jenks dissent on Watkins, but Jenks decided about 2 weeks before Watkins. In Jenks' dissent, Clark had said that this was the one opening the FBI files where they were used in a trial. The defendant had to have a chance to see them too. The prosecution witnesses were using them. Clark said something to the effect that unless Congress undoes the evil it's done this day, that we've opened a Pandora's box. I wonder, among the justices, is this considered to be going a bit far to urge Congress to, a minority justice, to urge Congress to reverse the majority? It isn't usually, I mean, it's unusual. I just wonder.
I don't know if it's happened before or not. I would think we could probably find other examples if we searched.
Probably.
It just indicated the very deep conviction on Clark's part that the decision was so wrong that something ought to be done about it immediately. Of course, the case was greatly misunderstood. A lot of things were written about it that were not true, that this enabled the person accused of subversion ransacking FBI files. What had happened actually was that FBI witnesses, FBI agents who were called as witnesses, had become sort of white cows, sacred, because they testified without any possibility of re-examination on the basis of the reliability of their memory. An ordinary witness can be asked a question, did you at the time of the incidents that you were referred to make any notes or memoranda? Yes, I did. Then the request is made for the production, and those notes are usually produced unless they are, a communication between a parishioner and a priest or something, a husband and a wife or something like that, with those exceptions, they are produced. And we all know that the memory of man is very treacherous. Sometimes things as far away as 5 years or 3 years of telescope become one with the passage of time. And people make mistakes. FBI had become, as I said, into a very favored position with his witnesses who were officers, because they could not be required to produce any notes that they made concerning the episode, and we didn't see why. If there were notes of that conversation made, or notes of what the agent saw made, that those shouldn't be produced, they shouldn't be treated like ordinary witnesses, because the liberty of the citizen was at stake, and the country was beginning to find out that some FBI agents were notorious perjurers.
Yes, the man involved in this case was arguing it too, so
yes.
He got a great deal of notoriety at some time. I wonder if we could move on and discuss the conference in the New York school prayer case of last term, Tingle versus Vitale, which was decided last term.
Checked into the White House.
said I was ready to report. And I went over and saw Truman, and I said, well, I got a report for you on Nehru. And he said, Nehru is a communist, isn't he? And I said, well, he's about as much of a communist as you are, Mr. President. He said, oh, don't give me that guff. He said, Nehru, sit right in the chair you're sitting in. And he said, I can smell these communists a mile away. He repeated what he'd said in June. And the report that I had on Nehru was like shouting into the hurricane. There was no possibility of any kind of a bridge or nexus or understanding at all between Truman and Nehru. Not for any shortcoming on Nehru's part, because he's a pretty worldly man and get along with all sorts of people, but they don't breed that kind of person around Independence, Missouri.
Probably a bit too subtle for Harry's taste. On April 11th, 1952.
No, Truman was very provincial. He knew very, very little about what went on in the world. I mean, he didn't, of his own personal knowledge. Of course, when he was president, experts brought him all sorts of information as to conditions and problems. But he started with very little understanding. And anybody who didn't fit the Democratic Republican pattern of ideology in America was a dangerous person. Truman did not know the world of ideas. He did not know the world of philosophy. He did not know the world of religions. He would give me long lectures about the Persians, and they were the demonstrations of the greatest ignorance I've ever known from a person in a high place. He just didn't understand. He was a very, very ignorant man at that level.
In April 1952, you wrote President Truman that you fully concurred in his decision to relieve General MacArthur, and you alluded to a recommendation you had made to this effect the previous October. I wonder if you would explain the reasons behind your recommendation.
Well, one of the things that I got into when I got out to India in 1950, and when I got up to Hong Kong, was the status of the UN Army and its relationship to the 36th parallel, and whether the 36th parallel should be crossed. And I think I've discussed that previously. Nehru had at that time a very active embassy in Peking. I forget the name of the ambassador, but Nehru showed me the dispatches from his ambassador saying that the United States should know, and England should know, and other nations involved in the UN action in the Korea should know that if the 38th parallel was crossed, that Red China would enter the war. And and Nehru asked me if I would carry that message to Truman. He wanted to make sure that Truman got it before it was too late. I said that I would, and I did report it to Truman. On the way from India to the United States, I stopped in Hong Kong. Three Chinese came out to see me. I'd known a man in the States by the name of Lu, L-U, who owned most of China's coastwise shipping. A very wealthy man. I had dinner with him in Washington, D.C., I think in 49, and might have been the spring of 49. He decided to go back to China, to Peking, cast in his lot with Mo Tse-tung. I tried to dissuade him
telling him that I was sure they would liquidate him in time. He said no, said that I have a lot of skills that they need building this new nation, new regime. They're communists, but they also tolerate other people. And of course, they did at that time keep some symbolic groups around, even in their government. Lou was still alive in 1915, came up to Hong Kong with a couple of others. One was a member of the Chinese, Red Chinese Congress, and another was another Chinese businessman, a friend of Lou's. And they had the same message to give me, that for Truman, at that time, also set forth at considerable length other ideas they had. One was that the United States government and the Peking government should get together, should exchange ambassadors, that the Peking regime was anxious for a trade agreement, that Peking did not want to get too closely dependent upon Russia, and so on and so on and so on, that they wanted cultural exchanges, they wanted a settlement of the Formosa issue, they wanted peace with the United States, and but everything had to start with stopping at the 36th parallel. And I had been back, and when I got back, I went in and reported that to Truman. There was the message that Mr. Liu gave me in Hong Kong. I summarized them in some detail because they were at that time very fresh in my mind. And when I finished, Truman, who had been sitting there rather nervously, said, "Are you finished?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, let me tell you something. I have better intelligence than you've got." And I said, "What is your intelligence?" He said, "They're not going to come into the war." I said, "How can you be so sure?" And he said, "Because General MacArthur, who knows more about the Chinese than you do or anybody else, tells me that." I said that these representations of Nero and Mr. Liu were from very reliable sources, and he again said, "Well, Nero was merely a communist or a tool of the communists. He wouldn't trust him. He'd trust MacArthur first." And I kept on pressing him. I guess I was in there perhaps an hour, wasting his time and my time, because he finally ended the conversation by saying that if the Red Chinese won't come in, of that I could rest assured. Secondly, that if they did, that they would, and then he used some very foul, strong language, that they would be battered to a pulp. The aftermath of that, of course, was clear. They did come in when we crossed the 38th parallel, and they almost drove the UN army into the sea, and was a great tragic thing with a loss of 140,000 American lives, and we were, ended up back at the 36th parallel in a sort of a needless exhibition of a drawing of blood between two nations. That was all in the background of General MacArthur, and I kept reminding Truman that my intelligence had turned out to be better than his, and that this General MacArthur was going to ruin him in Asia. As I said, Truman was a very ignorant man about world affairs. He was a precinct politician. He was cute. He was popular with taxi cab drivers. He was tough, big
vigorous little campaigner. But what he knew about the world, you could get into a peanut shell. In Asia, he just absolutely had no conception of the aspirations of Asia, the peoples of Asia, the color question in Asia, the hatred of the whites are building up in the yellows and the browns. MacArthur was striding the stage of Asia, was the great new symbol of white man's power, white man's strength, white man's domination over these little inferior coolies. And MacArthur did great injury to the image of America that had been built up for decades through missionaries and through businessmen, traders, schooners, who had been built up through teachers, through students coming here and going back. That was largely destroyed by the symbol of General MacArthur that meant grinding down the little yellow man and putting above him the white warlord. I don't say that MacArthur meant to do all those things, but that was the terrible symbol. And I kept reminding Truman of that. Truman, MacArthur was going to ruin him and politically. And the letter of April 11, 1952,
lead us right on to our next question of what you think the judgment of history would be on Truman's presidency.
Well, I don't know. I think that for his courage and outspoken manner in which he pounded away at simple little points on the domestic scene, he will perhaps be well remembered. He was a colorful little, I always thought of as a pygmy. He was not a man who understood what went on in the world. And it's to think of him sitting with him and Jimmy Burns, Secretary of State, sitting with Stalin, dividing up the world. Would be like sending a couple of immature high school students to play poker with the pros. Those men didn't know the world. They didn't know the problems. And Truman never did. To this day, to the end of his presidency, and on and after, there were some good things that he did. And whether they're due to him or to others, I don't know. I think it was a bold thing he did in going into Greece. I think it was an important thing. Greece, I happened to know Greece at the time. It was in complete disintegration. And it would have been a communist takeover in a year. It took courage to go in, not as much courage as some people thought at the time, but it was a commitment of a kind, and he had that kind of sturdiness, a willingness to stick out his chin and fight. The trouble is that many times he didn't know what he was fighting about. Like in Korea, it took courage, I think, to go in. I think it was an advance in international law for the UN to go in. I think that actually the Indian statement of the necessity to go into Korea was much more worldly wise than the Truman statement. Truman gets credit for it, but that was a rather unanimous decision of the United Nations at the time,
and Truman implemented it quickly and promptly, and the American forces were the largest unit in the U.N. Army. I think that those two things required courage, and I think that Truman get a lot of credit for it. I think that two things that he did are unforgettable and unforgivable. First is the way in which under Truman the military became stronger and stronger and stronger in America. He catered to that. He was had been a captain, and he I think was sort of fascinated with generals. He kept them around the White House. He turned to them for advice more and more, and as American history is written, I think people discovered that it was Truman, not Eisenhower, that let the Army and the Navy and the Air Force in the back door, and gradually became dictators, largely dictators of American foreign policy. The second tragedy was that Truman, in his great vast ignorance of the world, extended principles of the Marshall Plan to the feudal regimes. Marshall Plan worked well in Europe because there were foundations of viable democratic societies on which new plants could be built. It took very little to get Europe going again, but the rest of the world, that includes Africa, the Middle East, Asia, Latin America, had never had that political development. And so the pouring out money to these feudal regimes was like throwing it out the window. There was nothing to build on. There was no democratic society, no foundations there. People were, in Persia, people were 80-90% illiterate. The whole country was owned by 200 men. And the 200 men got a great part of the $2 billion. And the people at the bottom were worse off at the end of it than at the beginning of it. Truman, in his naivete, promoted point four, and people picked up the drums and Voice of America dramatized it. But point four in a feudal society is nonsense, because all you do when in Persia, for example, where the peasants pay 80, 85, 90, 95% of the crop for rent plus interest on loans that their grandfathers had made from the grandfathers of the present owner, you increase production of those agricultural lands, and all you do is to make richer the landlords who are already